Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 12th of May. Calling them organizations and associations that are going to be essential to the work of healthcare reform in this country, President Obama, over the past couple days, has been meeting with trade associations, pharmaceutical groups, and other stakeholders in the healthcare debate on an effort that they say could save more than $2 trillion over the next decade. The president said the meeting focused largely on one of the central challenges that we must confront as we seek to achieve comprehensive reform and lay a new foundation for our economy, and that is the spiraling cost of health care in this country. When it comes to health care spending, we are on an unsustainable course that threatens the financial stability of families, businesses, and government itself. Joining us this hour to talk about this coalition of groups and what needs to happen to change health care in this country is a guest who joins us fairly frequently. Professor Helen Halpin is a professor of health policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Her special interests are increasing access to health insurance, consumer experiences in managed care, smoking cessation benefits, and integration of health promotion and disease prevention services in the U.S. healthcare system. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to join us by email today, is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org for you to join the conversation. Professor, good morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Was there something unusual about this coming together of people from pharmaceuticals, from labor unions, et cetera? Was this something new?
Well, we haven't seen anything quite like this probably since the 70s when the industry launched what they called their voluntary effort to control costs, which wasn't sustained for very long and didn't have any effect. I mean, it's hard to know what they mean by this. They said the language they used was that it was a commitment, but it really is a voluntary effort. I think it has a lot of symbolic value. There are no rules or accountability or any way really to hold them their feet to the fire to this promise, so that, you know, the weight of it is questionable. But I do think that the symbolic value, particularly the fact, I'm puzzled that the SEIU, Service Employees International Union, is in with this group of medical device makers, health insurance plans, pharmaceutical companies, the hospitals and the doctors. They are odd bedfellows, I will definitely say that, and politics often makes them. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what it says about the future of the reform. Clearly they want to get out ahead of this thing and come out as looking like they want to be players this time rather than obstacles. But I would take that with a grain of salt, because we really haven't gotten into the details where there will be some fierce battles over how we actually go about reforming this system. So I think this is a great first step. They've all come together and said, you know, this time things are so bad, costs are going up so much, it's so unsustainable that we want to be part of the solution, and yet there were very few specifics in what they offered.
And you wrote an interesting piece talking about the fact, after spending a week on the Hill meeting with congressional staff on health care reform, that your biggest fear is that everybody's taking their corners itching for a fight.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's already happening. I mean, the group that did those Swift Boat ads on John Kerry has reorganized and will be producing ads against health care reform.
Mm-hmm.
It'll start again very soon, I'm sure.
Right. The president talked in his speech yesterday about getting health care costs under control being essential to the health of the whole economy, to reducing budget deficits, restoring fiscal discipline, putting our economy on a path toward what he called sustainable growth and shared prosperity. Do you see it that way as well, that it's part of the whole economic picture and at that a very important part?
Absolutely. The big question is whether any of these things they do will have these so-called savings that we expect, and who will those savings accrue to? Not necessarily to the federal government. I mean, the concern is that if we keep going up at the same rate that we are now, we'll hit 20% of our gross domestic product going to health care by 2018, which is really isn't very far away. and if it keeps going up like that, it'll eat more and more. We'll have less and less discretionary funding available for anything. And so I do think that this needs to be addressed. It can't be addressed by itself, though. Without the delivery system reform and the insurance reform, we're not going to be able to control costs. No one really knows how to control costs. We've really only been successful for very brief periods over the last 50 years. Nixon put wage and price controls on the hospitals and the healthcare industry in the 70s to try to control costs. After Medicaid and Medicare had gone into effect, costs skyrocketed much higher than anyone had ever anticipated, and there was huge pressure in the Nixon administration to bring those down, and he actually froze them, which for a Republican is a pretty radical thing to do, and they are, you know, being frozen, they didn't increase for that period. But the minute the wage and price controls were released, they went right back up to where they would have been if they hadn't been controlled. Mm-hmm. So that didn't work very well. The other success that we had was in the 90s with the introduction of managed care and health maintenance organizations, and we actually did see, again, a reduction in the growth, and costs actually decreased for a short period. But once all those gains from reducing unnecessary hospitalizations and managing care kicked in and became more part of the culture, then costs went right back up again. So it's a really difficult problem. Other nations are struggling with the same problem. Our situation is different in that we're starting with such a high base. You know, we're spending over $7,000 a person already. And so most countries, even countries that provide better health care and have had better health status, spend half of that or less.
We're spending $7,000 a person.
Yes, and we have 47 million who aren't even covered.
Right.
So something has to be done, but I think many scholars and policy analysts believe that you can't just go after costs alone, that if you don't address the quality and the access and the delivery side, you cannot reap in these savings. And no one knows for any one of these things how soon the savings will accrue. Mm-hmm. Now, the good news, I think, is if you look at the president's budget and you look at the Recovery Act, there are already provisions in there that are going to force these industries, other than the unions that came together yesterday, to accept some pretty drastic cuts. And that budget has been passed, so those will go into effect, and they affect the hospitals. But close to 20% of all people who go into the hospital are being readmitted in less than a month than they were just discharged, which is a real problem. It means they were discharged too soon, or maybe they were discharged with an infection, or they had some sort of complication post-discharge, but they're coming back in and costing us a fortune. And what the budget and the Recovery Act do is actually change the way hospitals will be paid in the future, and they won't get paid a payment for an admission based on a diagnosis anymore. They'll get paid for that. It'll be a bundled payment plus the cost for 30 days of your care post-discharge. So the hospitals will be responsible for a month after you leave the hospital, which should give them an incentive to do much better discharge planning, make sure you go home to somebody who can actually take care of you, that you know how to, you know, take your medications and can fill them, and that you haven't been discharged with an infection.
Right.
And so this is very interesting. What they're doing, what they're accepting basically, is an alignment of incentives, and they're taking responsibility not just for the delivery of the care, but for the outcome itself.
Hmm. What did you say the readmission rate was? What percentage?
It's 18%.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. And so that alone, they asked the they estimate would save $25 billion over 10 years.
Hmm.
Then if you look at the health plans, what they've essentially agreed to, health plans currently are getting paid about 14% more than the average cost of the person in their plan, which is quite a profitable business. But this is a government program, so it's not supposed to be designed to give HMOs profit. So basically what they have proposed is to reduce those overpayments to the HMOs. So they would get a 14% less payment, and they'd switch to a competitive bid system to the HMOs. They would bid for the Medicare contracts, and that was estimated to save $177 billion over 10 years. And then the pharmaceutical companies similarly, we'll be making some concessions in the provisions in the budget and the Recovery Act. They, in that bill, it gives the increases the rebate that the Medicaid program gets on prescription drugs, brand name drugs, from 15% to 22%. So that's a 7% increase in the rebates the Medicaid program will be getting. And they will allow states to collect rebates for prescription drugs for their Medicaid managed care plan. So, the, and then finally, they're going to link hospital payment to performance, and that's about $12 billion. So even if you just add up the provisions that are in the budget and the Recovery Act, pharmaceutical companies, the hospitals, and the health plans have agreed already to cut $2.1 trillion.
Whew. That's quite a bit.
It is.
Yeah,
now, whether those savings will can be realized or not, I don't know. I don't know if those, my guess is that those are estimates, though, that have been scored. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Now, what the hospitals and the pharmaceutical companies and the health plans and the medical device manufacturers and the doctors will do beyond this to achieve their 1.5% per year rate of reduction in the rate of growth of healthcare costs, I'm not sure, and they have not been specific about it at all. But I found it odd that the White House released these this $2 trillion in savings from the Budget and Recovery Act as part of the package of the announcement over how the industry would save $2 trillion.
I know that you have been a strong champion. You describe yourself as such of a public plan option.
Oh, yeah.
But you have written, while progressives are pushing hard for that, that progressives may need to be prepared to even let that go if they want universal coverage.
Well, I don't know how that's going to go yet. My guess is that this public plan option, which would give Americans the choice of either private plans or a new public plan where they could, sort of like Medicare, but hopefully better, where they could go to any doctor or hospital they want. They wouldn't be restricted by their health plan as to what doctor or hospital they could go to. They'd have a comprehensive set of benefits. Their premium would be subsidized. There'd be no health insurance company between them and their doctor. And it would look very similar to a single-payer kind of program that would operate in parallel with the private health plans. The idea is, we, you know, a lot of people and many people believe, and I think there's evidence to suggest that you can run a healthcare system and insure everyone much less expensively under a single-payer plan. I mean, there's just no question about it. But this is the United States of America, and we developed a voluntary private health insurance system in the 1930s that grew to cover about 70% of the population by the mid-50s. And this is the foundation of our system. And I especially in one of the worst economic recessions we've seen in a long time, it's hard to imagine how very rapidly one could put all of the private health insurance companies out of business overnight and switch to a single-payer system. What's brilliant about this public plan option is that it would allow the U.S. to begin to transition towards a single-payer system, but at the will and on the basis of the preferences of the American people. No one would be forced into it. No one would have to choose it. You could still keep the insurance that you have. And many people believe that this is to let the American people decide which system they want to get their care is sort of the ultimate American solution. And the progressives feel so strongly about this, actually, that Howard Dean came out a few weeks ago and literally drew a line in the sand and said, if any health care bill that comes out of the Congress does not have this public plan option in it, we will not support it. Which is a pretty radical thing to say. I mean, I think it's a good thing to say. What it does is, it again, it's symbolic. A lot of symbolism going on here, saying, you know, we won't accept anything less than this, and just laying that on the table at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is, and the Senate Finance Committee late yesterday afternoon, came out with their first white paper on health insurance reform. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it. But they completely dodged the issue of the public plan, which is probably smart of them at this point, because this is going to be, I call it a knife fight. It's going to be a knife fight. It's not going to be pretty. There are people who don't want this. The fact that this could lead to a predominantly single-payer system makes conservatives crazy.
Right.
The other problem there is that the far left that wants single-payer, they're very suspicious of this. They don't believe it will work. Steffi Wohlhandler and Himmelstein, who are run Physicians for National Health Insurance, they have put out a paper arguing that the public plan won't work. So it'll be attacked from the left and the right, which actually gives a great credibility as a centrist position.
Exactly. What's the bottom line for the administration? They will accept no less than what?
Well, they have not made statements like that. President Obama is very careful not to say things like that. The most recent statement out of the White House was the president likes the public plan option. Mm. That, to me, is not a very strong statement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what will happen. In this white paper that came out yesterday from Senate Finance, they laid out three options. It was more of an options paper rather than anything that looked like legislation. They said that we could have a public plan option, and the first one would be to design it just like Medicare, with Medicare rates and, it'd function like Medicare. And Medicare benefits, I don't know. I think it felt kind of like a red herring, because Medicare has lots of problems, and I think many people would welcome Medicare as an option to buy into. I'm not sure that we want to extend Medicare to everyone. I'm not sure that Medicare was designed in 1965. It's been very difficult to reform. It's got lots of problems, and physicians now aren't taking it. So I think it might not be a great idea to call this new plan something that they've already decided they don't like. But
right.
Anyway, that would be option number one. Option number two would be to let each state form its own public plan. And then the third one was no public plan. So clearly the Senate Finance has not made a decision about this. Now, my guess is... Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, the problem with Senate Finance is that Senator Grassley, who is the minority leader on that committee, and Senator Wyden don't like the public plan option. And they have their own bill, which is a comprehensive universal coverage reform, but it doesn't include the public plan, and it has a lot of bipartisan support. And the reason that I had written that the progressives should be really start to think hard about whether they can accept this is Obama shows a willingness to compromise over certain things. And my sense is that if a plan comes out and it covers everyone and it's a good benefit package and it has the cost controls he wants and it regulates the insurance companies so they can't do the things that they're doing now that make it difficult, if not impossible, for people to get insurance, and it has subsidies in it so low-income people can afford it, and it emphasizes prevention and wellness, I think he might sign it.
We're going to welcome a ton of phone calls, people already on the line. I love this guest because she's on top of everything, and it's so complicated. Professor Helen Ann Halpin is with us, professor of health policy and director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. Our phone number, the lines are busy right now. Just keep it in mind, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Tom. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. One of my questions is it doesn't seem like the common man is being represented at the table. The other thing is if they keep on doing the way they're doing, it doesn't sound like it's addressing a lot of the administration costs, because there's going to be a bunch of different types of health care out there to choose from.
Yeah, well, it would lower it in some ways, because in order to get a subsidy based on your income, you're going to at least the way the Senate is envisioning this now, and the way Senator Obama had during the campaign, you're going to be going to this exchange, insurance exchange, and so you'll have to choose one of the private plans in that exchange, and in the exchange they would be much more heavily regulated than they are right now, or you'd go into the public plan in that exchange if there is one there, and so only plans that that met the standards in terms of the comprehensiveness of the benefits that they offer, the rules that they agree to operate on for pricing, and all sorts of other things that, you know. And it would limit the number of plans that would be available to those that were qualified. You could at least be assured, hopefully, of buying a higher quality product, a more regulated product, and get a discount on your premium based on your income. So you're right. It certainly doesn't achieve the level of administrative savings that a pure single-payer system would. Mm-hmm. But depending upon how popular the public plan option is, we could very quickly realize many of those savings through that option.
And do you imagine that it would be? Would that public plan be attractive to most of us?
Well, I think my guess is what would happen at first, it would be most attractive to people who don't have any insurance,
right,
and who don't want to deal with an insurance company, don't want to give their money to an insurance company. We don't know how many people that would be. We modeled a similar idea here in California back in 2001, and we found that about 70% of the population would go into the exchange, and about half of those, or 35%, would go into this pool. So 35% of the American population is a huge number.
Right. I know.
So it could potentially be sustainable pretty quickly. I think people who have employer coverage or that they like would keep it and wait and see how it looks mm-hmm. before they jump in, because you will be able to keep the coverage you have if you have coverage now.
Thanks, Tom, for the call. Scott from Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Good morning. I'm a ER physician, and there, I think most physicians, of course, have strong opinions about their daily practice and how this would affect this, or what needs to be considered, I guess. I just want to make a couple points, particularly with reference to a statement earlier that, you know, people back hospital charge implying that something was missed. And I'm not going to be to defend.
You know what? We really can't hear you. You're breaking up.
Yeah, you are breaking up. I'm sorry, Scott. Can you call us back? We want to hear what you have to say, but we just can't hear you right now. Thanks very much. Mike is next from Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Just a quick observation about Medicare. I don't know if the president addressed this, but we essentially have 300 million people in the country. 60 million of them are baby boomers. 2 years ago, the first baby boomer retired, and 10,000 a day are going to retire for 20 years in a row. Virtually everybody is going to be on Medicare that needs medical assistance, at least, you know, in great proportion. I don't know that the president Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are really trying to tackle reforming Medicare. It's like 25% fraud and waste in Medicare, and we're not addressing the huge tail wagging the dog, which is Medicare. That's the thing we need to address, at least in huge part. I wonder what the guest thinks.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they're very aware of it, I think an important part of this reform will be significant Medicare and Medicaid reform. What was so I agree with you, and I'm part of that baby boomer generation, so I'm very aware of it, and believe me, the Congress and the President are too. I think that if you look at if you go to whitehouse.gov, you can actually see the list of participants at the meeting. You can read the statement, the letter that these groups wrote to the President, and you can read the President's remarks. And you can see this fact sheet that I was talking about how they'll make the cuts. I don't think there's any question that reducing fraud and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid is a huge objective. We've been trying to do this for a long time. It's a very difficult thing to do. There haven't been any more specifics about how they'll go about doing it, but you're absolutely right. And there are many, many changes that need to be made to the Medicare program to bring it into the 21st century and make it a desirable insurance product, both for the beneficiaries as well as for the physicians and the hospitals. The payment rates under Medicare right now are in many places perceived as just too low for doctors to accept. Any health reform that we enact has got to be perceived by physicians as being fair in its payment, and we absolutely have to reduce both administrative rates that the previous caller talked about, as well as the fraud and the abuse of this caller. So I think everyone's aware of it. I think that they're looking at a package of reforms for Medicaid and Medicare that are separate from this expansion effort, and I think we can expect to see some of that coming down the road.
I think that most people would agree in this country, and you feel pretty strongly about this issue, and I do as well, that all Americans should have affordable health care. The president said in his address yesterday that indeed all Americans should have health care.
Yeah.
Is this going to be a part of this plan? Are we finally going to get away from this? We have 45 to 47 million people without health insurance, which is awful.
It is awful. Actually, in the documents that when President Obama was a candidate, he opposed an individual mandate on people to buy insurance. With the way the Senate wrote this white paper yesterday, it looks like they will embrace an individual mandate to purchase insurance, but not until everyone has access to either the exchange or has insurance.
I see.
Or has access to insurance. I think the way they dealt with people who couldn't get insurance is they would certify them as not being able to find insurance they could afford, and then in the future some accommodation we've made for them. We're not going to get to universal coverage overnight. It's just not going to happen. There are pockets of people who are really difficult to find and serve. But if we can get to, most economists will tell you we can get to probably 95 or 96% of the population covered relatively rapidly. Most people want health insurance, and if they can afford it and they perceive it as good value, they'll take it. To get to 100%, you have to understand, even in many European countries where they have cradle-to-grave coverage, they do not have 100% coverage. It's just really difficult to get some people to actually sign up to a program and keep track of a card. And
right.
So the goal is universal coverage. They'll put a requirement on everyone once they're sure that everyone has access to a product they can afford. So they won't jump the gun, and if there aren't enough subsidies, like what happened in Massachusetts, you can't afford people to buy coverage. So I think that it'll be a humane approach to some sort of what they're calling personal responsibility, which means you have to kick in what you can afford for your premium, and you are responsible for having coverage.
Thank you very much, Mike, for your call. We have a couple lines open. 800-486-8655 is our number. Dan from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello.
Dan, you want to turn that radio down? Thanks.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Hello. Dan. Go ahead.
Yes, I don't have a radio on, so it can't be me.
Oh, okay. I don't know what it was.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I'm retired military, and so I have TRICARE, and then when I turn 65, I get TRICARE for life. How will all this affect us, since it's another government program? Will that change?
It won't affect you at all.
It won't affect military.
No.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Here's an email that's come in. The only way to cut health care costs is to do, as every other advanced country has done, destroy the for-profit insurance company and for-profit hospital. If you're unwilling to do this, this is a pretty harsh one. You're happy to see people die because you want to make more money. It's just a matter of how many. The for-profit companies are nothing but pure evil, and we should treat them as such.
Well, that is a pretty harsh statement, and I know a lot of people feel that way. They're not pure evil. They are for-profit companies. They are doing what their mission requires them to do, which is make profit for their shareholders. And I agree. I think it was a mistake to ever open this door. But you know what? This happened in the 30s. The first plans in this country, and still the biggest insurer, are Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans. And they were nonprofit plans. They were community organizations. They community rated, and they were perceived as good guys. When the commercial insurance industry saw that these Blue Cross Blue Shield plans were doing well, they decided to get into the business, and they began offering health insurance along with the fire insurance and the life insurance and all sorts of other insurance that they would sell to corporations. And so the for-profit insurance industry has been part of this system from the very beginning and has had about half of the market shares almost from the very beginning. So this, they are part of the foundation of our system. They are not evil. They moved in to fill a niche, and they saw a way to make a profit from that. Now, whether or not one can continue to allow them to perform that function, I think the best option, honestly, is to make them compete against a public plan. There's no doubt in my mind that we can operate a public plan more efficiently than they can operate when they've got to worry about shareholder equity and advertising and marketing and all the other expenses that they have to try to maintain their enrollee pool. So you can't vilify them. What they're doing is legal. They're not doing anything wrong in terms of the law. But what we do is need to give Americans a better option, a different option, so that people who feel as strongly as that individual, who don't want a dime of their money right. to go to a for-profit health insurance, have another place they can put it with confidence.
Let's go to Nora from Marinette. Hi, Nora.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to say that I think both in the public sector and in the private commercial insurance, we spend way too much time dealing with illness coverage and not enough with health prevention.
That's absolutely
and
right.
Will those new programs cover health prevention?
This is an area that I've been working really hard in, and I was so delighted yesterday to see this white paper, because there is an enormous part of it addressing specifically prevention and wellness and giving people access to all preventive care that has been demonstrated to be effective and to require that you don't have to pay any money out of pocket to get preventive services, so there's no barrier in terms of cost to accessing those services. Also making sure that people have access to community-based programs like exercise programs or weight loss programs or stress reduction programs in their community, all sorts of incentives for the system as well as individuals to improve their behavior, giving incentives to work sites who offer work site wellness programs, giving reductions on or rebates or rewards to people who complete health promotion programs. It's really a huge step forward. It's something that the prevention and public health communities have been looking for decades, and I think we're actually going to see a significant change and movement towards recognizing the value and importance of preventive care and hopefully preventing a lot of this costly illness down the road.
Thank you so much for your call. Eddie is next from Solon Springs. Hello, Eddie.
Hello.
Eddie, you have to turn your radio down, I think.
I'm there. You got me?
We got you.
All right. Well, I love the conversation. Just have a few comments. I mean, I think your guest has made some great points, but a couple issues. One, she framed the conversation fairly early on with a 18% readmission rate as if that was data that suggested failure, as opposed to recognition of the natural history of terminal illness and chronic disease. And so to put that burden on a hospital, when many of the hospitals are community owned and community sponsored, seems quite unreasonable unless we address the elephant in the room, which is the America's expectation of terminal care and the role of palliative care.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Unfair burden on the hospitals.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, you're sort of opening up a whole another can of worms regarding end of life care, and we need a culture shift in how we think about death, and not think of it as a time to be spending millions of dollars on heroic efforts, but a time to be with our families and to say goodbye and be grateful for the life that we've had, and to be comfortable and not in pain and to prepare for that. And so I agree with you. I think that if Americans could come to terms with death and the natural progression of chronic disease and how to have a good death, I know that may sound odd, but I believe that it's a really important concept that we need to embrace, especially given this aging baby boomer population, this caller's right that it, people do recycle in and out of the hospital, but I think that hopefully with at least some better discharge planning and better placement, and, you know, you've got to have a good placement. Many people don't have one to go to, and that's a huge problem. But I guess the idea is that if you align the incentive that way, you're at least giving someone responsibility for trying to coordinate that care after the hospital and prevent these to the extent possible. I don't know how far it can go down. I don't know what's realistic, but that's just what the White House had cited as the basis for their reason for imposing these new bundled payments on the hospitals. And honestly, I don't know if this has been tried anywhere. You've now piqued my curiosity, and I should look and see if any states have done anything similar.
Am I done, or do I have another comment?
No, Eddie, you're not done. Go go right ahead.
I appreciate that, but again, I think first of all, I should frame this. I am a single payer supporter. However, we have to pick the right targets, and to place the burden on hospitals, especially community hospitals, which are the first line of defense, and you know, we are the insurance company for the uninsured, as opposed to placing a heavier burden on the for-profit industries. You're picking the easy targets, and the hospitals are stretched right now, and they're cutting nursing staff. I think your conversation frames it as if these nurses and hospitals are not trying to do their very best to do adequate discharge planning, and they are doing great discharge planning. But our hands are tied in so many ways, and to cut the organization, to cut the profit.
Yeah.
Or
you know what, this is part of a trend, and I have a feeling it's going to spread like wildfire to physicians and nursing homes and everyone else. It's pay for performance. And the idea is you won't pay people anymore for the quantity of the services. You'll pay them for the outcome. And so the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services began in January with hospitals under the Medicare program, they won't pay them for certain infections that patients get in the hospitals anymore. So the hospital now has an economic incentive to prevent that infection. I think it is controversial, and I think it's not clear how to align these incentives to make the delivery system pay more attention to outcome and not just process. And I think that we're in somewhat uncharted waters in knowing what our effects of doing these things are. I think you raise a really valid point.
We're going to take more phone calls in just one moment. We're happy to have with us, she knows so much about all the plans that have been put forward to fix health care in this country. She's a vital part of the health care reform debate, is Professor Helen Ann Halpin, Professor of Health Policy and Director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, how to keep your brain healthy, active, vibrant for many years of your life. Let's go to an email before we go back to phone calls. Isn't healthcare the one part of the economy that has jobs? Will payment reductions sink the last floating boat in the economy? What's wrong with spending money on healthcare rather than any other service industry, Helen?
Well, we are spending a lot of money, about $2 trillion a year, and it's going to grow even more. And, yes, it continues to be one of the fastest-growing sectors of the economy in terms of jobs. What's interesting is it's hard to know how to answer this question because, on the one hand, costs are not going to stop going up. I mean, the costs in healthcare will continue to go up. The goal here is to reduce the rate at which they go up. So it's not really cuts in that sense. I agree with you that at least for primary care physicians, we need to increase their payment in order to attract more primary care physicians. Our delivery system is a mess because we've got way too many specialists and not nearly enough doctors and nurse practitioners and other personnel who can provide the primary and preventive care that everyone needs. But I wouldn't worry about it. The technology is booming. The medical device industry is doing well. We're going to need more and more technicians for this industry. Hopefully, nursing staff ratios will improve in an effort to improve the quality of care and the outcomes of care. So I'm not worried about this industry being hurt in terms of growth. But there does need to be some regulation of that growth because a smaller and smaller percent of our budget is available for things like education and environment and with entitlement programs and healthcare continuing to grow up, the pool of available resources for discretionary spending is shrinking, and that's not good news either. So we have to look at this more holistically, and healthcare is certainly an important part of the economy, and I don't think that will change, but we do need to manage the growth and make sure that the money that we are putting in is going to patient care and not to other things.
Gary from DePere is next. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, I listened to a program earlier this morning that Joy had, too. And I listened to several of these along the way, and nobody seems to have a thorough, detailed discussion as to how the Canadians, the French, the English, the Japanese, and the Germans fund their health care system, and what does it cost per person? Nobody does that. They just talk around the edges, and I think if America probably knew about it, they would probably throw away the politicians and get with it.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at European countries relative to us, many of them who provide really good care and their population health status is better than ours spend $2,000 or $3,000 a person a year.
What's
compared
wrong
to 7,000.
What's wrong with us?
What's wrong
with
us? We want everything and more, and for years and years and years, we had what we called a cost-plus system. So that and usual and customary charges, so that basically that the insurance industry for a very long while would pay the healthcare providers whatever they spent, and the more they spent, the more they paid, and the higher the costs went, and there was no regulation and there was no incentive to control it, and then with defensive medicine, physicians became concerned and began to practice in a way that again required more tests, more diagnostics. And Americans want the latest and greatest thing.
I don't think that the Europeans are less human beings than we are.
I'm not saying human beings, but they developed a regulated system that the government controlled from the get-go. We're trying to rein in something that's completely out of control. It's like wild horses.
We're going to really be out of control. Kathleen, I think we need a detailed show on this.
Oh yeah,
we've
done lots and lots of healthcare shows. We've looked at all of the different systems, but we'll do others. Believe me,
you bet.
We're on it. All right, thanks, Gary, for the call. Let's go to Jenny next. Jenny calling from Oshkosh. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I was just wondering. I use Medicaid. My husband passed away last year, and he was very sick, and he was using Medicare. We've had both issues with the prescriptions, both with Medicare and Medicaid, with him getting his diabetic medications and medications for cancer treatment and all those types of drugs. We needed pre-authorizations that would cause him to wait for weeks and months to get his prescriptions. And then also my son, who is on ADHD medication, if the doctor tries to change his medication, we wait for weeks to get his medication for the pre-authorization. I was wondering if that will improve with some of this public health care system.
Well, I would hope so. No one's talking at that level of detail. I really believe that we should let doctors practice medicine and not put administrators in between physicians and their patients. There are so many examples of these kinds of delays with pre-authorization and pre-approval. Some of the plans that have studied it have found that it actually they approve 99% of the stuff, that it costs them more to go through this process than anything they're saving from denials. So it really is kind of a silly a silly practice that actually creates a great deal of harm. So I would like to see it done away with altogether. Whether that will happen, I honestly don't know.
Okay.
You've had a rough go of it, haven't you, Jenny? I'm sorry. Ooh.
Oh, yeah. It's been I've learned a lot about healthcare.
I'm sure you have.
More than I wanted to know.
Yeah. Well, that's see, and my heart goes out to you as well. I think this is what happens to most American families. They think the healthcare that they have is okay until they really need to use it. And then they discover that it's just not there for them in a timely way and in an effective way.
Yes. Thanks, Jenny, for the call. Sky is next from Washington Island. Hi, Sky.
Hello.
Hi.
I was sort of wanting to say to you, I'm getting some funny feedback on my phone, but I'm really concerned about the fact that our entire system is completely controlled by allopathic medicine and the thinking that derives from the practices of it. And this goes everything from the use of drugs, and there are so many efficacious alternatives to drugs that can't be checked out because of FDA regulations, and no one can afford to check out, you know, vitamin B3, for instance, or whatever. And there are so many other wellness-oriented systems like naturopathy and acupuncture, and it seems that the more we exclude all these things, the more we're going down this path. It's sort of a one way of thinking. And
I think this is slowly changing. There is an Office of Alternative Medicine in the Department of Health and Human Services. They do not have a very big budget. They are funded to do research. I think the shift that I see happening in designing what people have access to in terms of their benefits is the idea of evidence-based. And so in a similar way to where preventive care was 20 years ago, no one was going to cover screening or mammography or pap smears or any of these things without proof that they were effective. And so what happened is we built the research base for preventive care, and now that area of medicine is probably better studied than any area, and we're going to have a really comprehensive set of benefits for preventive care. I feel that's where alternative medicine is now. There isn't a strong evidence base. We need a lot more money going in to actually research the health outcomes associated with these treatments to give them the validity that they need and that I think the public probably would want. Most health plans now do cover acupuncture. They do cover chiropractors. Many of them will cover certain vitamins. So we're moving there. It's just painfully slow. And unless there's a huge investment in research into these alternative treatments, I think it's going to be a long time before they're embraced. But given this new frame of evidence-based medicine, I do think there's a much greater potential now to move to adopt effective alternative practices. So that's about the best hope I could give you.
Thank you, Sky, for the call. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Scott from Minocqua. Hi.
Hello. I got a comment that kind of goes with Jenny and the gentleman that called before her. All these other, well, now, I know Canada and I believe Germany and some other foreign countries, they, you know, everybody's got health insurance.
Yeah.
But from what I've heard, sometimes it takes up to a couple years maybe even longer to get in, say, for heart surgery or cancer or whatever, you know, the case may be.
Yeah. And, no, I think they give very good care. This is these are the rumors that the insurance industry used to spread and probably will be spreading again about these systems. I don't know if you've ever been to any of these countries and gotten ill, but you get outstanding care with no questions asked. And so I think what you're hearing about and where there is some truth is that for elective procedures, so for something that's non-urgent and non-life-threatening, you might have to wait a few months. I don't know if anybody's waiting years, but they do in effect, ration certain kinds of care. It's hard to imagine that we would get to that here in this country. We ration care right now based on your income and your health status, so that if you have a low income and you don't have employer-based insurance and you have poor health status, you can't buy insurance. That's immoral. I would much rather have people know they can get this elective procedure to have that mole removed, but they're going to have to wait 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. Professor Helen Ann Halpin, always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for all of your expertise. Thanks. Our guest this hour, Professor Helen Ann Halpin. She's a professor of health policy and director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health, responding to all that's new on, and there will be a lot more new as the days go on, the president meeting the last couple of days with organizations and associations that he says are going to be essential to the work of healthcare reform in this country, with an announcement, no deep plans yet, that they will be saving trillions of dollars in the next decade. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up in just a moment, and then we will return with more Tuesday morning conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.